This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Leavenworth Prison in Kansas is the nation's oldest federal penitentiary. And though it's one of the most dangerous maximum security prisons, the cells are open until 10 o'clock at night. The inmates can walk around freely, which is why my guest, journalist Pete Early, chose it as the subject of his book on life behind bars, The Hothouse. Early spent 2 years as the only journalist ever allowed unlimited access to Leavenworth. But to gain that access, Early had to agree that prison had no responsibility for his safety. Once inside, Early was faced with having to establish trust with the prisoners while protecting himself from them at the same time.
Most of the officers there either wear a body alarm or a two-way radio. There are no weapons because it would be too dangerous. A convict might take a weapon away from you. And I was offered a body alarm or a radio, but I decided not to wear one because I didn't want to look like the staff. I wanted to try to keep that impartial feeling in the atmosphere. So I stayed with the guards the first time I went in for about 3 weeks, and I finally ventured out into the yard. One of the things you realize in prison is that both the guards and the staff test each other. And I was tested. When I was out in the yard for the first time alone, I was surrounded by about 400 convicts in the yard. And one of them came up to me and they said, "Do you know who that inmate over there is?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Well, you should find out. He kills reporters." And I later found out it was Bruce Pierce from The Order, the fellow who machine-gunned Alan Berg, the Denver talk show host. Now, I never ran into Mr. Pierce, but that didn't matter. What they were doing, the inmates around me, were going to see how I reacted, because convicts have a special sense of fear, and whenever they feel fear, then they can prey on people.
You said at Leavenworth that the cells were open from 6:30 in the morning until 10 o'clock at night. What did these inmates do all day long?
Well, again, about 80% of them simply went to work. The Bureau requires most of them to have jobs. And then they'd get off before the 4 o'clock count, which is the important prison count. Everyone has to stand up in his cell and be counted. And then they'd go to recreation, or they'd go to college classes, or they'd go lift weights. The Bureau has a number of programs to keep them entertained. And the institution itself, if you were to walk in, is not a hellhole. It's a spit shine, and it looks very nice, and they have all these programs, and they feed the inmates very well. The reason it's such a terrible place are because of the other 20% of inmates. Those are the predators, and they try to do the same thing inside Leavenworth they did on the street: run drugs, booze, card games, prostitutes, and pull cons on each other. The difference is they have to be much more clever, because the people they are tricking are other convicts who will kill them.
What would spark a fight?
Just about anything. One day I was talking to an inmate in his cell, and the music of Hank Williams Jr. started blaring in the cell next to us. And this man said, "Excuse me." He stood up. He went and got a shank, which is a prison knife, and he tucked it in his pants. He walked over to the cell and said, "Your music's too loud. You're disrespecting me." Now, luckily, that inmate turned it down. The inmate came back, and he told me. I said, "Gee, would you have attacked that guy over something like this?" And he said, "Of course, because that's disrespect." And I said, "What would you have done?" And he said, "I would have run the gears," which is prison slang for saying the best way to kill someone is to jab a knife into him and then pull it up and over and down and over, just like if you were changing gears in your car.
You said a shank. Now, a prison knife, is this something that the inmates make, they fashion out of something else?
Right. And they're very ingenious about this. Convicts are not stupid people. They're very ingenious about the kind of things they need to do to survive. For example, most common shanks are made out of any kind of metal, a piece of metal broken off a chair. Then you put cleansing powder on the floor and just simply scrape a point on it. But I saw perhaps the most clever shank I saw was a guy who was in total isolation, and the only thing that was brought to him was a styrofoam lunch or breakfast or dinner covered by a sheet of clear plastic. He saved the plastic every day for a month, rolled it up as tight as he could until it was a long pencil shape, heated it with a match, and had a plastic shank with a point on it, and tried to put a guard's eye out with it.
Does everyone have a shank inside of Leavenworth?
Well, it's impossible to tell how many there are. They usually find two or three a week. These are things that people don't usually keep in their cells. And it depends on what the climate is. When things get bad and the inmates know it, then you'll see guys actually wrapping themselves in magazines, taping them to their chest under their shirts to use as body armor. And then they'll start what they call strapping, which means carrying shanks.
My guest is Pete Early, and he's the author of a book on Leavenworth Prison called The Hothouse. You had said earlier that the guards are not armed. How do they maintain order?
Well, they do it through a number of ways, psychological and also physical. The most immediate way is, if you're in trouble and you're an officer, you punch your body alarm, which emits a loud squealing signal. Then every other officer who is not in a tower or manning a gate is supposed to run immediately to that area. And the idea is you'll have 30 or 40 guards running up on a situation, and that will scare the person off. Of course, what the Bureau's also discovered is if there's ever a riot situation, that's one good way to take hostages. Another psychological message that is sent is what's called standing main line. Every day when they have the feeding in the mess hall and they have 400, 500, 600 inmates in there, all of the prison top officials from the warden down come and stand in front of the group. Now, during that time, any inmate can go up and ask a question or talk to them or anything else, and that's technically the reason they're there. But there's also a message being sent. We're not afraid of you. We don't have weapons, and you outnumber us 20-1, but we'll stand right here while you eat lunch because we're in charge.
How would you then describe the relationship between the inmate and the guard? And you talk about the kind of power relationships going on inside of Leavenworth Prison.
Well, it's one of dehumanization on both levels. I was shocked when I found out that most officers had no idea what the men they were guarding had done, what kind of crimes they had committed. And later I found out this was intentional. Perhaps a captain put it to me best. He said one day an inmate came to him and said, gee, this guy down the hall is going to rape me. You got to protect me. You got to do something. And it was a guy who was about 26 years old, and he was actually in tears. So the captain said, just a minute. And he went and pulled the file, and he found out that this guy had kidnapped two children in Michigan, small boys, 3 and 5, taken them to a mountain, sexually abused them, lit them on fire, and eventually killed them. And he said, before he knew what that fellow had done, he had some sympathy for him. But then he thought, geez, look at what kind of creature this is. And yet he struggled with it in his mind, and he finally came back and he said, I finally decided the reason we treat these people the way we do, we treat them with respect, we treat them well, is not because of what they've done, but because of who we are as individuals. And that was how he dealt with that. But both sides dehumanize the other. Both of them do not like to know that much about the crimes. The inmates, for instance, try to know very little about the guards. And if the two sides start to get in a situation where a guard and inmate get friendly, both sides start pressuring that person to back off.
You interviewed one of the guards, and he said, I can be violent, just as violent as any inmate in here if the situation demands that. I can even kill. I've killed many men, but I am not a predator. And that's what separates us from them. We don't cross that line. Was that true with all the guards, would you say?
Well, that I should explain that guard had killed people when he was in the military in Vietnam, and that was why he said he'd killed very many men. To be a guard, you had to be very tough and also resilient. These are guys who have feces and urine thrown at them regularly. They're guys who are threatened and the inmates try to intimidate them. And again, it's interesting, about 80% of the guard force handled that, were extremely professional. You didn't have any trouble with them. And then there was always about 20%, which mirrored the image of the convicts and the predators. And these guys were constantly getting in trouble, and the Bureau was trying to weed them out. The problem is this. You can have all the PhDs and masters, and you'd be surprised how many correctional officers have college degrees and advanced degrees. But you can have all those you want. You can talk all you want. But when it comes down to it, and you have a guy standing in his cell, and he has a shank, and he's covered himself with his own feces, and he's thrown soap on the floor, and he's yelling profanity at you, and he wants to kill someone, you have to have somebody who's just as big of a brute and just as big of a beast who's not afraid to go in there and take care of the job. And that's why you always have a level of guards that are accused of brutality, etc.
Tell us about the pecking order within the prison. Who maintains this control, this 20% that you talked about who are not cowed by imprisonment? How do they maintain control? How do they prove themselves?
Well, the inmates divide into various gangs, cliques, and groups. It's a totally racist environment. The largest percentage of black inmates in the institution come from Washington, D.C., and they're known as D.C. Blacks. And they were run basically by one person, which was interesting because he really kept control over the whole group. Now, the other groups did not have one strong leader. You had the mafia, which stayed by themselves. Then you had the White Aryan Brotherhood. That only consisted of a couple of fellows. And the rest of them, maybe 20 or 30, were wannabes, people who wanted to join and become part of this AB gang, and they served them. And then you had just various cliques within the group, and then you had this couple, only a few, lone wolves. And most of these folks, you'd had splinter gangs, the Georgia Boys, it was regional, et cetera, et cetera. But most of the inmates there would identify with the area they came from or with people they knew. Because you have to remember, everyone always talks about going into prison and hearing the bars slam behind them. That affects convicts, too. They're just as afraid when they enter an institution as anyone else.
And how did inmates use sex as a way of maintaining power?
Well, what I discovered was that what you see is any kind of weakness will lead to people taking advantage of you. One of the fellows who I interviewed who'd been in for 23 years said the only way you survive in here is making it clear that if anyone wants to take something from you, whether it be your commissary or have sex with you, you have to make it more painful for them than they will make it to you, and therefore they'll let up. What I discovered, though, when it came to inmate rapes, perhaps the inmate who I discussed this with described it best. He said he had been raped when he was in prison. Three guys attacked him when he was 16 and raped him. And he later got out, and he remembered the pain and anger and humiliation. And then he got in trouble in Arizona, and he was thrown in a jail cell with a 17-year-old. And he raped him. He beat him up, and he raped him. And he said while he was doing that, he remembered that humiliation, and he felt bad about it. But it was just this great sense of power that he had. And how when you're at the bottom of the heap, and everybody else tells you what to do, and everybody else can dump on you, all of a sudden you have someone you have complete power over, and he described it like a piece of meat. I can do anything I want to this person. Now, I heard the same kind of comments in killers who had described shooting their victims and watching them, you know, crawl towards a phone and letting them almost get there and then shooting them again. It's almost like this godlike power over someone else. And I discovered the rapes had very little to do with sex as much as it did with just being able to humiliate another human being, because these fellows felt that they were being humiliated in the system.
How much consensual sex was going on, would you say, inside of Leavenworth?
Well, I think, that's very hard to judge because this was something that was very difficult for inmates to talk about, but I think there was an awful lot of it. Again, one of the inmates I spent a lot of time with me said that you really don't have to rape anyone. There are a lot of services provided. There were a lot of prostitutes who were willing to trade a carton of cigarettes for sex. The problem that most of the inmates had with that was that if you took someone, if you raped someone or you took power over someone and made them your punk, then that showed a certain amount of power or, class as opposed to someone who is running to a prostitute. I mean, the outlaws aren't supposed to have to buy sex. Also, the convicts feel very strongly that the Bureau encourages homosexuality because that psychologically makes you feel less of a man. If you're heterosexual and you're forced into a homosexual relationship, you feel like you are less of a person. And the convicts who consider themselves hardcore convicts really detest the fact that there aren't conjugal visits, because if they cross that line, they see themselves as being weak. And the first step to being weak is to have someone take advantage of you, and then you become a rat, et cetera, et cetera.
My guest today is Pete Early, and he was the first journalist allowed free access inside of Leavenworth Prison. He did his research with no promises of protection. He spent 2 years on and off in the prison researching his book called The Hothouse. And we're going to talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Pete Early. You write that inmates rarely had trouble finding women to visit them or to correspond with, and a fair number of these relationships turned into marriage. Were you able to understand the attraction that a woman would have with a man who was, we'll say, sentenced to life in prison or 25 years in prison?
Well, one thing is that convicts, by their nature, understand people. They look for weaknesses just like a psychiatrist would, but then instead of trying to help someone, they take advantage of them. And these guys would write letters and put ads in papers, and they would get a tremendous response. Two or three or four women would start writing them. And the thing convicts have is a lot of time. So they would write long, long letters, 20, 30 pages, passionate letters to these women and get them to come visit them. And the third Thursday of every month was reserved for weddings, and there were always weddings, even guys who were in forever. And a lot of the women fit the stereotype, low self-esteem, et cetera. I found it interesting when I talked to them about their explanations of why they came. Some of them were kind of frivolous. One woman said, well, at least I know where he is at night. But another woman told me about the time that she had married this guy, and she knew he was a bank robber. He'd been in prison, and then he went back in prison, and she went to visit him. And while she was waiting in the visiting room, another inmate walked by and made a crass comment about her figure. And she never said anything, but other inmates told her husband. And so that week, he broke the guy's arms and beat him up. And the next week, he came into the visiting room and told her about it. And she was thrilled because she said, gee, nobody ever cared enough about me to do something like that.
Did you ask yourself, when you were working in investigating and reporting inside of Leavenworth, how you would have survived if you had been an inmate there?
Did that come up? Well, you wonder that because I think anybody who goes in immediately puts yourself in that situation, which is dangerous because you tend to put your feelings onto an inmate. I'll give you an example. When I met Tommy Silverstein, who is kept in this basement cell, he killed a guard, stabbed him 57 times, and so the Bureau has put him in the basement of Leavenworth in a steel cell that has two lines of bars in front of it. It's kind of like Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, and this place is so isolated, you can't even hear toilets flushing. All you hear is the buzz of the fluorescent lights. And the lights are kept on 24 hours a day. And he's been like this since 1983. And when I first saw him, I felt a tremendous amount of empathy because, my Lord, this guy sleeps with the lights on and everything. And it really bothered me, and I kept mentioning the lights. And then he finally said, gee, you know, I never even thought about those lights. I just close my eyes and go to sleep. So you got to watch, you know, putting yourself in. But to answer your question, which I was avoiding there, you do think about it, and I don't know how I would have survived because the bottom line is you're going to be preyed on unless you're willing to kill someone. And so you get these strange things that happen in prison. One day, a white and a black inmate got into an argument, believe it or not, over whether to watch Jeopardy or watch Vanna White on Wheel of Fortune. And the black inmate was very good with his fist, and he pretty well embarrassed the white inmate. That night, a number of whites came to him and said, you've embarrassed the entire race. You have to take action. So the next day in the mess hall, this guy approached the black from behind, threw a towel off of his hand, and he had a 17-inch shank there, and he thrust it into the black man's back, trying to sever his spinal cord. Now, when I interviewed that guy, he was very keen on having me know he hadn't tried to kill him. He said, look, if I wanted to kill that guy, I would have jumped him in a stairway, and I would have stabbed him 30 or 40 times. That was to save face. All I did was hit him to show everybody I wasn't a coward, but I don't want a life sentence over this. Please make sure everybody knows I was just doing that to save face. I had no choice.
Now, an experience like that, does that make you feel any more or less vulnerable when you're outside, when you're out on the streets?
Yeah, you get extremely paranoid. And you also get, what happens is you get sucked into the darkness of Leavenworth, and the guards face this all the time, too. My reaction to that stabbing, I'd been in a long time when it happened, and my reaction was one of disappointment that the guy hadn't died. And I know that sounds very sick, but at that point in the institution, everyone was so, it gets so compressed that you want a release. And you'll hear guards talking about a good stabbing because for days after that, everybody talks about it and you feel like, phew, at least it wasn't me. And the other thing I discovered is when you come out, that paranoia stays with you. One of the things the convicts told me was the first thing they do when they get out is they get a gun. And I thought, well, of course you get a gun. You use it in the crime. And they said, no. If you've been in Leavenworth and you see what people are really capable of doing and how evil they can be, you want to protect yourself. These guys are more scared than the rest of us when they're on the street.
Do you still have contact with any of the inmates that you interviewed?
Yeah, Silverstein called me last week. He's allowed a 15-minute phone call every month, and he called me, and there are about two or three of them that I correspond with regularly. Usually a journalist goes through a period where after a book comes out, it cuts off that association and moves on. It's part of pulling away from the project, getting yourself out of it. In this case, I think I would like to continue writing to some of those men simply because, as strange as it may sound, we kind of shared this experience. It's weird in the sense of when you're in a place like Leavenworth, everything seems more intense because your adrenaline's pumping, because you know you could be injured. And that intenseness kind of brings about a friendship with both the inmates and the guards that seems much stronger than when you're on this street.
What did you and Tommy Silverstein talk about?
Well, almost all of Silverstein's letters are about how much he hates the guard and how much he's being abused and how terrible the system is, because that's his entire world. You also have to realize the way you survive in a prison when you're someone like Silverstein who's been taken, everything taken away. In 1983, after he killed a guard, for 6 months, he sat in a cell with nothing but his boxer shorts. For 6 solid months, no one to talk to. The way you survive by that is through hate and through your own pride. I'm not going to commit suicide because I'm not going to give these guys the satisfaction. And then you develop what they call beating the man. Throw Kellogg's cornflakes in your toilet bowl and let them sit there for a week, and you'll get a drink that you can get intoxicated on. Take the plastic off your meal and make a knife. You've just beaten the man. And so this game comes up of how you beat the man, and that's what keeps you going. And so you focus on that interior world. One of the things you discover in a place like Leavenworth is once you're in there, you forget about what the outside world is like. You even start to dream that you're in prison. And one of the scariest episodes I had, I was talking to a fellow who was a bank robber, and he said, when I first came in here, I used to dream about having sex with my wife. Now I dream about raping a guard. And he said, in my dream, it's all black and white. And then I pull down this guy's pants and I start to rape him. And all of a sudden, a knife appears and I'm stabbing him in the back. And the dream goes to Technicolor. And I keep having this dream. And then he turned and he looked at me and he said, Pete, I wonder what I'll be dreaming in 2 years when I get out.
Hmm. What do you dream about?
Well, I have had a few dreams about Leavenworth, but luckily I'm getting out of that. Authors don't have time to dream. We're up at night working. We're too nervous about the next book.
Well, Pete Early, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Pete Early's book about Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary is called The Hot House. We spoke earlier this year when the book first came out. The paperback edition of The Hot House will be published in February. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.